It's Shabbat bowl. Come, and the portion then this morning was from Shemot Exodus 12, 1 through to 14. From Haftarah we had there the prophet of Jeremiah, that was 46, 20 through to 28. And from the Messianic writings we had there what I call the open letter to Jewish people everywhere, otherwise known as the letter of Hebrews. We don't know who wrote it, but it certainly seems to have been penned post-destruction of the temple in 70 CE, and was addressing the need, as it was also within Pharisaic circles and other Jewish circles of the first century, how do we as Jews survive not having a temple? And the letter of Hebrews seems to have been written with that in mind, but we were looking at particularly chapter 3, 1 through to 15. Do you remember a time, now if you're as old as I am, not many of you are, some of you are a little bit older, most of you are much, much younger than I am. But do you remember a time, sometimes I look back nostalgically and think, I remember a day when life was normal. Do you remember those days? You know, you'd kind of get up and things were normal. You'd go to work or school, or there'd be food on the table when you came in, and the garden was lovely and the sun came up and food was available in the supermarkets, and you know, I remember those days. In fact, you know, those days weren't even that long ago. I would suggest maybe if you scroll back to pre-economic crisis, let's go back to 2007, maybe, before the world really started to go completely nuts and normality became just a word in the dictionary. You know, I remember those days, I'm sure many of you do remember those days. There was a certain, what I would call a certain certainty to life. Predictability. Stability. I think if you try to put words into it, it would be those kind of words. You kind of knew what life was and you knew your place in it, and you know, you could travel and you could do things and you could buy with certainty and you had some income and, you know, by and large all things were normal and you kind of got on with it. And our world seemed to be then plunged into a lack of certainty, a lack of stability, a lack of normality, where in the last couple of decades that's all gone, hasn't it? You know, post-pandemic, global crash, wars, economic, political crises everywhere. Uncertainty, frankly, is what we've got today. Sometimes you're fearful, like I am. Sometimes you turn the news on at 10 o'clock at night and you're sitting there covering half your eyes like Doctor Who. You're thinking, like, you know, what's going to come next? It's so fearful. What's the next thing going to be? You know, rather like the sea devils coming out of the sea and the doctor's there with his magic screwdriver, you know, and you're sitting there going, no, what is coming next at me? Because it's just too much. And we've talked about this before. But we're in an age now of uncertainty for many, many people. We're beginning to hear people calling out for the strong man who will lead us to the sunny uplands again. And we see around the world democracies under threat, the rule of law under threat, free journalism under threat, all in the name of certainty. We don't want these kind of things because they get in the way. We need certainty, we need strength, we need stability, and we'll push anything out the way that appears to remove that certainty. The strong man demanding putting it all to rights. There's no surprise around the world we're seeing that slide into autocracy and dictatorship more and more and more. Even people beginning to say in the West, you know, it's quicker and more efficient that way. And you know it is. It is. If you've got a dictatorship, it is highly efficient. But you enslave your population. Can't argue with it on one level. It is maybe quicker and more efficient to do things that way. It takes more time if you have to ask people and talk to people and take in different views and everything else. But you know, there's so many parallels in all of this from what we are seeing in today's world and all the uncertainty that we've got. Parallels going back to, of course, ancient Egypt. I'm reminded again, there was a famine, wasn't there, in the land. And a certain Yosef brought in draconian economic rules, and as we read through the scriptures, divested people of their own wealth and control of their destinies, effectively making the people of Egypt slaves to Pharaoh. And of course, later on, Pharaoh himself brings it full circle by enslaving us Israelites, the Hebrews, too, in that place. And however much we may look at what Yosef did in those days, his aim was noble. It fed the people. It worked. But at the end of it all was slavery and worse. All these parallels to ancient civilization of Egypt with today, I think, are quite startling. The world of Egypt was the pinnacle of civilization at the time. Dictator and a self-proclaimed god at the top. And if there's one thing that Egypt had, it was certainty. If you worked, you might have got your meagre rations. If you didn't, you were whipped. But at least it was certain, right? But because of all of his unrighteous actions, enslaving a nation, the Israelites, to enrich himself and Egypt, God's judgments rained down on him and his country. He thought he had stability. He thought he had certainty. The people thought there was certainty in Egypt. Even if life was tough, at least it was certain. At least it was stable. At least it was predictable. And we knew where we were. And then the judgments of God come along and just explode it all sky high. And so what was Pharaoh's response in all of this? As most dictators do and people who want to control nations and countries. He began to fight anything and anyone who challenged his conceptual, political and religious world. He fought every single one of them. Of course that also meant us as Jews. Because we Jews have always danced to a different tune. We have rules and laws which are not like their rules and laws. And that means, of course, inevitably Pharaoh was going to target us too. But there's one thing about Pharaoh, one thing about that drives people like this in the middle of chaos to try and restore order and restore certainty and stability and predictability. Such men are arrogant. And Pharaoh was one. Consumed in his own arrogance, he concluded that he was always right, that every action he took had divine status, he was beyond correction, above the law, and was certainly never required to change in any way. That's who he saw himself as. So convinced was Pharaoh that he could never be wrong that he even decided to fight God. Now that's a battle he was never going to win. How deep must his arrogance and self-certainty or conviction of himself and his power and his ability to bring certainty to the world, how deep must that have gone to think that he could even fight against the one true God? But he thought he could. He thought he could win. And we're barely 24 hours away from yesterday with the International Holocaust Remembrance Day, recalling another man, another Pharaoh, whose arrogance knew no bounds, whose self-confidence that he was always right and could do no wrong, drove him to fight God and murder 6 million Jews. Certainty. Conviction. Stability, predictability that Hitler brought to Germany. You know, we can't joke about it, we will not joke about it, but you know, even within Germany, the quote is often said, but at least Hitler got the trains running on time. And he did. He built thousands of miles of motorway. He built the first real motorway north and south through Germany that the cars from Volkswagen could go up and down, and the Germans were overjoyed. You can drive fast. Hitler gave Germany certainty, stability, a conviction that they were right, with historical destiny to bring the Aryan race to the domination of the planet. And in the process, of course, just eradicate anything and anyone who gets in our way. Hitler decided to fight God. Pharaoh decided to fight God. People do this because they are so sure in themselves that they are right. Hitler was so convinced, so certain in his worldview and understanding that the Jews were to blame for the economic decline and woes of Germany and the problems in this world, so certain and convinced in his own mind as a tenet of faith that this was true, that he literally tried to exterminate us wherever he found Jewish people. And while he never declared himself to be a god, like Pharaoh did, he certainly acted like one. Untouchable. I suspect that after the attempt to assassinate him, you'll know there was an attempt to assassinate Hitler during the war. You know, and he was meant to be there at that time and place, and just by chance he was not, and survived. And it's little moments like that where I'm sure in Hitler's mind he thought to himself, I can't be stopped. I'm untouchable. Even when they try and come for me, they fail. Even to the extent of using biblical Jewish motifs like the thousand-year Reich, the thousand-year kingdom, the millennial kingdom, Hitler believed he was the one who had the right to set this up, drawn from the Jewish scriptures, from the very people he sought to exterminate. That's how deep that arrogance goes, how deep that certainty went in that man. What is it that truly links such people? And believe me, the list could go on. Those are just two examples, but there are many. What is it that really deeply links these people? The certainty, yes. But you know what drives that certainty? That they are right and everyone else is wrong. What drives that certainty is a hardness of heart. Scripture is very clear on this. We read that God hardens Pharaoh's heart, but he only did so after Pharaoh had already chosen that route for himself. People often say, be careful what you pray for, because God just might answer you. Pharaoh wanted to have a hard heart. He chose hard-heartedness as his route. It was the philosophical base of his own spirit, as it were, that drove him to become so certain of his own convictions as being the absolute truth, that he was absolutely right and he was unwaveringly sure in that conviction. He was hard in his heart. Have you noticed this in people? Where they are so absolutely certain of what they believe that they will do whatever it takes to achieve it. If you look at such people, you will meet in their eyes and their hearts and the fruit of their lives this hardness and contempt, harshness, an attitude of violence and hatred is what you will discover. If you're that certain of your own convictions, it'll lead you to a place of contempt for anything and anyone else who stands in your way or who would dare to disagree with you. Hardness of heart that leads to certainty, to people feeling and claiming that they are always absolutely right. Have you met such people as that? I know I have. Doesn't matter what you say, they're always right. Someone once said to me, I was hoping that I would marry Mr. Wright, and said I discovered his first name was always. But you know, it's going to be true. We kind of get ourselves into some very strange places. The certainty of being absolutely right drives people to act in ways of harshness, cruelty, dehumanization, and ultimately barbaric acts. The Nazis certainly believed they were absolutely right. Pharaoh certainly believed he was absolutely right. He had his view of the world and he was going to enforce it. And eventually it will lead you to exclude, dehumanize, act towards others who oppose you in ways which will become increasingly more barbaric. Now, we were discussing this in our deep study group during the week in our theology group. An interesting, really good session that we had there. When you couple these ideas of being absolutely convinced of your own rightness above all else, link that with the strands of purity and holiness, and boy, do you end up with a toxic mix. Imagine you see yourself as being absolutely right in every conviction that you have in yourself, and you then begin to see yourself as pure and everyone else as, oh, you know what, it's a shame you can't meet my exacting standards. I'm holy. It's a shame about you. And I'm absolutely sure about that. You're this far from a death camp. There's a message from all of this for us. And you'll be sitting there this morning going, yes, Rabbi, thank goodness, that's not me. Thank goodness I'm not like that with my soft and pliable heart. And of course, we would never even hope to find or seek to find examples of that kind of activity in Judaism. And thankfully, it is rare. But you know, it's not without precedent, this kind of hard-hearted action. Just think for one moment. When we came back from Babylon, Ezra's divorce plans. Many rabbis have said, and I include myself, and within Messianic Judaism, we include ourselves in this train of thought. Many rabbis have concluded, why didn't we just ask the women to convert and include them? Why bring that pain into Jewish families with the children who were affected by that, with forcible divorces? Think of a certain Shaul before he had that powerful spiritual encounter with Yeshua on the way to Damascus, where he fervently went around murdering Messianic Jews, and I mean murdering Messianic Jews, and overseeing their stoning and murder, and worse, thought that by so doing he was obeying God. Do we have examples? Oh, we have examples. People are so convinced that they are right that they will even put someone within the Jewish community to death. As Shaul did. So convinced that he absolutely had to back up his Pharisaic party and his view of how Torah was meant to be, that anyone who followed the Mashiach, Yeshua, in his day, as he was sent out, and he didn't resist being sent out, he went out happily and easily with the authority that he was given to literally kill Messianic Jews in the first century. And he did so. And each time he stood and watched or took part in those acts, he believed that he was actually pleasing God. He thought he was doing the right thing. He had certainty. Conviction. He wanted to bring stability back to the picture again. You can look at this, you can understand it from different ways. You can think, well, look, they were looking at this and with all the turmoil of the first century and the powers and the authorities and the leaders, and they were desperate to keep control and to tie it all down and at least try and survive. And I can understand it. I get it. I understand why he was sent out to try and stop this, because it must have looked as if this Messianic movement in the first century was only going to destabilize everything and bring confusion and lack of certainty. We hear it even today. Just a couple of weeks back, the chief rabbi in Jerusalem, where he was attacking Reform Judaism and Reform Jews and accusing them of trying to create a different Judaism, quasi bringing confusion and lack of stability into what Judaism is meant to be. Nothing has changed. We want certainty, we want stability, and we're convinced that we are right, and boy, are we going to enforce it. The problem is, with that attitude. It's not just the Hitlers and the Pharaohs of this world. We've seen it even in our own camp at times as well. Religious devotion, like any other devotion, driven by the absolute conviction that you are right, leads to ugly destinations. It always does. We all think we're absolutely right all the time. Thankfully, it's just as well I am. Because someone has to tell you what's what. You know what is really hard? Someone once said to me, you know, sorry is the hardest word. Yeah, it is. You know what's the harder thing to say? I was wrong. I can always count on one hand that people have sat in my office and said those words to me. In fact, it may not even be that many. I've had more people say sorry than I've had sit up there and say I was wrong. So hard to admit that you were wrong. Because to admit that you were wrong is to say that my absolute convictions and my certainty that I had in my life that I was right and I was on the right track, I was wrong, and I've had to admit that that was complete nonsense. And it's so hard to admit that we're wrong. But it's the word absolutely, I think, which is the key here. Because we're not saying that you can't have convictions that you think you're absolutely right. Pharaoh didn't want to admit he was wrong. And his act of trying to save face ended up with the slaughter of his whole army and ruined the nation of Egypt for decades, if not more. Having been, as he perceived it, humiliated by the God of Israel, his one last attempt to save that face and pursue Israel out to slaughter them at the sea ended up with his utter demise. That's where arrogance takes you. It's what happens if you fight God. It's where it goes. Doesn't matter how convinced you are of your own sense of being right. If you pursue those who you disagree with in that way, your arrogance will bring you down. Something we need to remember when we turn on those that we disagree with. Absolute breeds arrogance. Remember what Yeshua said in all of this? By this all men shall know that you are my disciples, if you are right all the time. No? No, I don't remember that verse quite that way either. Right? He didn't say that, did he? By this all men shall know that you are my disciples if you have love one for another. I don't read anywhere that Yeshua said, be right. I don't see Yeshua saying that we need to be right. He says we need to be holy. We need to show love. We need to live sacrificial lives. And by the way, in John 13, 34, 35, where that quote comes from, he says, and many people misread this, he says, he seems to be saying, I give you a new commandment, I give you, that you should love one another. That's not a new command. It's not new about loving each other. Love your neighbour as yourself. That is not a new command. It's a renewed command, as Yeshua taught it. Because he extended it to love not just your neighbour, but also including those who persecute you, those who hate you, those who are your enemies. And he renewed that command to bring out a deeper level of understanding of what the Torah was teaching. But nowhere did he say be right all the time. We like being right. We don't like being wrong. I wonder how many of you actually like being holy and pure. How many like being righteous? We tend not to talk about these things. We just want to be right, not righteous. Love is the fruit that shows that you follow God. When someone humiliates you, and maybe someone refuses to use your title in a correct manner, when someone chooses maybe not to even use a name that you have got for yourself as a Hebrew name, choosing maybe to use other names. This is not demonstrating the fruit of love of someone who follows God. Some people say to us in Messianic Judaism, you know, why do you call so-and-so rabbi? He's not a rabbi in your denomination. You haven't ordained him. And I always say, you know, at the end of the day, if someone has trained and gone through this structure and they've received a legitimate ordination, then they are a rabbi. I don't care who they are. We respect what people have achieved. We may not agree with them, but to not respect it is to show a dehumanisation which leads, well, we know where it leads. We need to respect each other. We need to show real love as the fruit that demonstrates that we actually are following God and not just our own desires to exclude and separate because I am right. You know, love covers that multitude of sins and errors. It forgives, it recognises that somehow we are all running the race, as Shaul would put it. And you know what? Somehow God will get us all over the finishing line. I'm not sure how he's going to get me over the finishing line. I'm confident he will get you over the finishing line. But somehow he will. He will. Because you know who's doing it? He is. Not me. Not your neighbour. He is. The race that we run with the finishing line that is at the end of it, as Shaul uses that metaphor, is a race that God is invested in to get us to that place. I'm encouraged that serving God is not about being right. If it was about being right, then I would suggest that none of us serve God very well. 30 years ago, I thought I was right. I would struggle today to name even one theology I still agree with from what I believed 30 years ago. I was convinced I was right. We had a Jewish man recently come to the synagogue a couple of weeks back. Maybe you're watching this morning, you'll know who you are. A Jewish man came and we had a discussion afterwards. He was not a Jewish man who believed in Yeshua. He was not a believer in that sense, but he was in the synagogue and he enjoyed the service. And the comment that he made to me, we were discussing about this, and it came up in the discussion about this idea about being right. And I was explaining to him, I said, you know, we in our community here, we encourage critical thinking, we encourage analytical thinking, we encourage that spirit of the Bereans to go back and check for yourself and research and study and learn. We encourage that in this synagogue because no one human being can stand here and say, I am absolutely right. And you know what he said when I was explaining this to him? He was shocked, first of all, that we would be that open to discuss and to talk. He said, you know, I've been in synagogues in my life. He said, the rabbis are always right. Always. That's unquestionable. If your rabbi says X, then X it is. And you do not question it. Because the rabbis are absolutely always right. One of the reasons why I think Rabbinic Judaism is in such a pickle that it is right now with the Agunot, the chained women, and many, many other situations which are coming up. Because if the rabbis are always right, and Rabbi X 100 years ago said that, and he's always right, you cannot question it. There's a system which is just literally waiting to implode. At that point, you know, holding strong convictions is good. Enforcing compliance, maybe not so. I think, as we've mentioned so often in the last few weeks, as Gamaliel correctly surmised, and he's right in his approach to this, if you approach everyone and everything, every situation, and the whole point of it is about being proven to be right, you end up fighting God, just as Gamaliel said. You know, Gamaliel's view was actually one of humility. He said, step back and watch. If this is of God, it'll succeed. And if it's not, it'll die. And he's right. 2,000 years on, Gamaliel, we're here. Because God is in it. But he had the humility to acknowledge that. Gamaliel was not a man, obviously, Even faced with Messianic Judaism in the first century, Gamaliel was not a man who was so arrogant to think that his own view was the absolute correct way and nothing else would count. He had the humility to acknowledge, here I am today. I don't maybe understand that. It's not what I would want to do. But I'm not going to stand here and pour judgment upon it because I may be wrong. You know, apart from anything else, God has given us judges and courts to decide such things and teachers to teach us. But so often, with our solid convictions, it seems to me that we need to step back occasionally and let God decide. Hold our doctrinal absoluteness lightly. We need to be sure, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have convictions in that way, but we should always have the humility to acknowledge with faith that God is the one who is always right. And we just might have got it wrong. God has given us the Torah. He's given us text. He gave us Yeshua. He gave us Yeshua's life and teaching as examples of living Torah, of how to live out the Torah in righteousness and justice. And still, we are merely human. Because you can read the same words as a million other people and you can still get 500,000 different interpretations. That's humanity. And that can either scare you or it can humble you. And humble you to seek God more. To leave that door, just ever so slightly, ajar. That'll say to God, Lord, I believe this and you're teaching me this. This is good. I'm convinced that this is the right thing. But you are right, O God, not always me. The humility and the faith of it all. And the interesting thing about this, I find, let me just read you another little passage here, because this is so critical for us. It's not just humility that counts in all of this. This is in the famous section, of course, in the book of Hebrews. Hebrews 11:3. See if you can spot the deliberate error. By eyes and by sight we understand, because we were there, that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so the things which are seen are not made from the things which are visible. Because we were there, right? We saw it. That's how we know it's true. There you were having your picnic on the first day, and you're leaning back and thinking, wow, God, this is amazing what you're doing. And you made that mental note to yourself to think, you know what, I know God made all this because I saw it. And maybe you didn't see it. Maybe you're of a scientific nature, and maybe you've done this in a test tube somewhere in a lab, so you're convinced that this is absolutely right. You know what? I'm going to be really, really controversial right now. I'm absolutely convinced that God made everything, that He's the creator of it all, but I didn't see it, I haven't seen it, and I cannot prove it. But I'm still convinced it's true. Why? Because of faith. Get it? By faith, we are sure, not by absolute certainty, convincing ourselves that we are right. By faith, we know. And the beauty of by faith, we understand that the world was framed by the word of God. The clue is actually in there. By faith we understand by the word of God. The certainty we have in anything comes from God's words, not ours. If I'm absolutely convinced that I am right about something, it is drawn down from an understanding that this is what God has said. Because He is always right. And the beauty of that is it gives me wiggle room to say, but Lord, sometimes if I'm not listening to you, I might actually get it wrong. But He is always right. By faith I understand. By faith we stand. And that takes you to a wonderful place of humility in it all. Because it's not you then saying, I'm absolutely convinced and so sure in myself that I can go and kill someone who disagrees. At that point we're saying, by faith I am sure in the Lord, but He is right and I could be wrong. And until I meet him in glory, I will continue to pray, continue to study, continue to learn, continue to find out, continue to be a Berean, continue to dig deeper, continue to understand and bring more depth and knowledge to every single thing that I do, believe and think and act. We are called to see God in everyone, not our own warped and twisted ideas of what is right and impose it upon them. We need to have a certainty that God is always right, but not necessarily that we always are. It means, yes, shockingly, we have to be humble. It means actually we should do what Yeshua really told us to do, was to live as he lived. He gave us an example to literally copy him. Imitate Messiah. Shaul said it. Yeshua imitated his Father in heaven. Shaul imitated Messiah in his life. Now, I don't see Yeshua walking around knocking people's heads together and saying, I'm right, shut up. Do you see that? What did Yeshua do? The bit of understanding that he had, of course, is Mashiach. He went around, but he told parables. He told stories. He lived things out. He demonstrated by what he taught. But he didn't just shove it down people's throats. Oh, no. There was a respect. There was a love. There's an understanding of the people that he was talking to were also human beings made in the image of God. And by his grace and his love and his mercy in his style and approach, by what he taught, he brought conviction, he brought challenge, and thus he brought change in people's lives. That's what we should be doing. And we can walk around like being absolutely certain and throw everyone into a camp and lock the door because, you know what, thank goodness they're out of the way because what I know is right. But we can do things that way if we want to. Alternatively, we can hold our absolute certainty lightly in our hands and say, as most of us I'm sure do because we go through this journey, today here I stand, but tomorrow God may change that. Does that scare you? Probably should. Because we all want certainty. If you want certainty, then live in Nazi Germany. If you want certainty, live in Pharaoh's Egypt. If you want certainty, go and live in a dictatorship. If you want certainty, go and find somewhere where everything is clear and everything is ordered and everything is stable and predictable. But I guarantee what you'll end up with is a slave. To be free means to live in the tension of it all. It's the mature place. And to do so will be to recognize when someone comes at you and sits in your face and is shouting at you. At that point, you'll have the humility to recognize that just maybe they're also telling you something you need to hear. Rather than just slamming the door on them and thinking, but I'm absolutely right and I'm not listening anymore. It's hard. It's tough. Because we want certainty. The only certainty that I have in my life right now is that God is God. That I'm certain of. I'm certain that Yeshua is the Mashiach. I've no doubt about that at all. I'm certain of his teachings, and I pattern my life upon them. But pretty much everything else, you know? Let us not be like Pharaoh, who hardened his heart. It's easy to harden your heart. Easy to think you're always right. Always easy to go on spiritual jihads, crusades, call them what you want. We mentioned them yesterday at the service. Those things are easy. They give you a certain self-righteousness and justification to be alive. But it's not God's way. Not Yeshua's way. Our God weeps over the death of every single sinner. He weeps over it. He does not rejoice in the death of a sinner. Nor should we. We should seek to bring that life into every single human being.